All right. Well, welcome to episode 9 of the Sick Nasty Deluxe Podcast, or SND, or, you know, whatever I change to next week. I don't know. I'm back again with Eddie.
Hello.
Yep. And, we're just going to start off talking about some shit.
Yeah. Shit.
So, yeah, did you see that DC released their digital rankings? So
finally, I did not.
Finally, we can see what's actually selling, even though they probably won't make any decisions based on that.
I'll be entirely honest, anything involving facts and figures, usually just my eyes glaze over and I just kind of skip over it. But I would gladly take the cliff notes.
Oh, well, basically, for some reason, and I think a lot of people probably expected this, they all thought that Justice League being the big, you know, the big issue that they're trying to, like, push on everybody, mm-hmm. would probably outsell any other book by a long shot. But apparently, on issues number 5, Justice League actually undersold Batman.
Really?
The Scott Snyder run, yeah. And, I mean, I think that's interesting just because around issue 5 of Justice League is when I started getting really fucking bored with it too. So maybe everybody is, you know, the market's just showing exactly how everybody feels about the book, and that it's, the Justice League book is just not good.
Well, is it number 2?
It's number 2, but I the name recognition and the way they pushed it alone, you'd think it would have outsold Batman. Maybe not by a lot, I don't know.
Well, where do the other Bat books rank?
The only other Bat book that's on there, I guess there are two. Number 6 is Batman and Robin number 5, and number 7 is Batman number 4.
Huh.
So Batman number 4 is still selling into that. Now, a few other books, number 4s were selling into that first month as well, January as well, and that was Justice League number 4 was up there as the other number 4 book. So people are still buying it a lot more than other books, but, like, Batman's beating it by a lot, it seems like. I mean, there are no actual numbers except for the rank, but the fact that there are two Batman books up there and both of them outrank the corresponding Justice League book.
Oh, see, I mean, there's a lot that could explain this. I mean, again, Batman is such a part of our everything pop culture that there's so much name recognition there that someone steps into a comic book shop, good chance they're going to try to find something Batman.
But it doesn't hurt that Batman is probably the best book that they're putting out, and Justice League should have been cut with the first 6 books at this point.
Yeah.
And it's not even like it started off interesting. Obviously, Geoff Johns doesn't want to be thought of as Geoff Johns anymore. He's completely changed on each of his books. For better or for worse, none of them, even Green Lantern's somewhat different. I mean, I would say especially Aquaman is, like, the most different I've seen his writing style.
But yeah,
Justice definitely. League is clearly not a book from the old, like, DC universe.
It's not in his wheelhouse. I heard someone phrase it this way, and I completely agree. Not Avengers. The Justice League needs to be the authority of the DCU, and I mean that, you know, in the authoritative super team, and like the more they need to handle the big shit.
They need to be the guys that everybody looks up to when you can't, like, you know, take down Darkseid, which was the first storyline.
Yep. Yeah. Which, you know, and that was one of the things that I got excited about. But I just. And I like how they're integrating Cyborg into that. I don't know much of the character, but
I love the fact that Cyborg's like in it. Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. But and then along with the fact that it's a weird Geoff Johns story that he's never really done before.
Right.
Combine it with they're already behind schedule, I think, on Justice League.
Yeah, they're one issue behind.
Yeah, they're already behind, and Jim Lee, at least in this issue, and even starting in the 4th issue, really was slipping. Like, he can't do this kind of schedule, and everybody said he couldn't do it, and then he promised he could, and he really can't. And I think he still has one more issue before another artist takes over for a couple issues.
Yeah, that's right. They've got a couple filler issues. Isn't that when the Shazam backup starts?
I mean, like, the sad thing is, like, where I might have dropped, like, Static Shock eventually. I don't think I ever would have dropped Justice League until it got canceled. Even though, like, I have this faith that it'll eventually find its, you know, balance between, like, you know, story and art and mm-hmm. fillers and everything. Because, you know, you have to expect with some of these books you're going to have fillers. I'm totally fine with J.H. Williams having to have fillers because every other three issues, you get his art again. And that's all that matters. And Jim Lee would be the same for me.
Well, see, Jim Lee just doesn't do it for me the same way J.H. Williams does. I mean, Jim Lee is a fantastic comic book artist, but J.H. Williams is an artist.
He's a painter, yeah.
Yeah, he does so much more and plays so much more with this sequential art. With a sequential art form as a whole, rather than just, you know, telling a superhero story.
You're not going to be blown away by the panel flow.
Exactly.
Jim Lee book. And I think that has more to do with Geoff Johns, I would say, or the writers that he works with, because sometimes you do. Like, did you read Hush, Jeff Loeb, and Jim Lee Batman book?
I have not.
I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, because Jeff Loeb, you know, whether or not it makes the story good or bad, he always does. He writes an interesting story.
Exactly.
It could be crazy and you just don't give a shit about it. Like, I would say 80% of his work is stuff I couldn't even read, really.
Uh-huh.
But you get that little bit of Jeff Loeb that's good and crazy, and I don't think Geoff Johns can do that kind of stuff.
Right. Geoff Johns, I think that you're onto something. Geoff Johns doesn't know how to go crazy. He's that kid in the class that can make, that you know, will make straight A's every time, but when it comes time
to... And he doesn't have to try at it, yeah.
Exactly, but when it comes time to make the diorama, he's completely and totally fucking lost because, you know, he can't get out of his own box.
Yeah, and, like, I think he's sort of run out of characters to be passionate about, and I think that's sort of what, like, maybe Aquaman's last one, because that's the book that I'm really liking by him now. Green Lantern's good, but it's always sort of been good, so it's not really surprising me.
You know, I was about ready to drop Green Lantern, but then they touched on, there was like just one throwaway little line of dialogue that I know is one of the...
Were trapped in the vault with all the other, you know, Sinestro-type people?
No, it was something Sinestro said that, it was, you know, one of those clearly I am the comic writer telling you, the reader, to hold on. It was, Hal asked, well, when the lantern ripped me apart atom by atom, or something like that, affected it?
I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and Sinestra's like, you know, oh, it did something to you, but we'll worry about that later. And I'm like, okay, that's going to be something, and I'm curious about that.
And that's true. And he's giving you some stuff there, and, you know, I don't care that much about a lot of it right now.
Yeah, I'm hitting one of those cycles too, where I'm not caring as much about the overall superhero world. I just want to find my one or two characters that I really want to just hunker down with and let that be that. But at the same time, though, I'm a fucking junkie. I gotta get my fix, man.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And with Green Lantern, it's been that way for me for so long.
Oh,
I
yeah.
can't imagine a world where I'm not reading Green Lantern. It's sort of like reading Thunderbolts for me.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. See, I mean, Green Lantern, when I first got into comics as a little kid, but I mean, when I came back to it in college, Green Lantern was the first DC title I picked up and stuck with.
That was actually the same for me, too. The Sinestro Corps War brought me back in.
That, you know, I was big into jumping on those. Oh, well, you know, they're starting a number one here. They've got a one-shot here. Let's try this out, because I don't know anything about any of this, so let's
that miniseries, that whole series was built on like a million little one-shots.
Exactly, but at the same time that worked because it drew me, and I feel like they could almost try to use that as a model for their crossovers and ways to reach more fans, but at this point I feel like
it was good because it was like I didn't have to buy every one-shot, but it was like, oh, I like Superboy Prime, I want to read a story in the war involving him, so I just picked up the Superboy one-shot.
Uh-huh.
Or I like Cyborg Superman, I want to read how he's involved, so you read that one-shot about him, and you don't have to pick up every single one, and you get the whole story. It's awesome.
Yeah, and on the other hand, if you're coming into it for that war, and you're like, oh, hey, I want to know more about this character, those one-shots were the perfect opportunity. Because, again, I knew nothing about most of these characters. So, you know, from in the span of, what was it, a year that event was going on, I got balls deep into the DCU, mostly thanks to that miniseries.
It's funny, they never tried to repeat that after that happened. Like, they sort of they went right into like the War of Light and everything. I guess I guess he did do some one shots for those, but after the whole Green Lantern stuff ended, you know, they abandoned that style because they went into the Final Crisis, and Final Crisis wasn't like that at all. It was like a million miniseries, and they were all like 8 issues long.
Yeah, see, that's why you have Grant Morrison write a book, but you don't let him run an event.
I don't know if he actually ran that event at all. I feel like really? He was like, fuck it, I'm going to make this story. If you want to make stories that tie into it, you can. And because of that, all the stories that people wrote that tied into it made no sense.
Got it. See, okay, that makes sense. I mean, I see this as someone who... I loved Final Crisis.
I did too. As a book on its own, I've got the hardcover. It's so good to read.
I got to tell you, that in that the fourth issue, there was one panel. It's like in the middle of the book where they finally turn Dan Turpin into Darkseid. And it was, what was it? What was his name?
They put a helmet on him. It looks like a Darth Vader ceremony.
Yeah. I totally loved that. I think that was a deliberate homage. But like Makari says, okay, something like thumbs up for, you know, the survival of mankind and thumbs down for a new genocide. And you see at the bottom panel, Darkseid's thumb going straight down. And it actually chilled me, the art, the writing and all of that. Like that is one, that book has one of my top five comic book moments.
I would
ever.
Actually say that in that moment wasn't, I mean, I loved the art in it. It was mm-hmm. especially that issue was amazing, but it was the final issue where Batman shows up, where in the throne room or whatever with Darkseid, and he just pulls out the gun and shoots him with the time bullet. And in that, for some reason, that panel just burned into my mind.
I love that
scene so much because especially in the Grant Morrison run on Batman, they were harping on the fact that he never uses guns, even though, like, you know, you could look at some Golden Age stuff where he used guns a lot. But, like, in this current continuity, he's very anti-gun, and he'll never use them. And then he used it to kill Darkseid, and I thought that was awesome.
Oh, yeah, he even said, like, for you, I'll break my rule.
Yeah, because just Darkseid is a guy who you can't pull any punches on, even for, like, sort of moral fortitude. You have to shoot him in his fucking face.
Yeah, and I feel like the Batman-Darkseid mashup is something that should happen more. In that Superman-Batman Apocalypse.
Oh, I was thinking, like, as soon as you said that, that movie was epic because you had Batman running around alone on Apocalypse.
Yeah, and I can't remember whether this happened in the book, the movie, or both. I know it happened in the book. I don't remember what happened in the movie.
It's been way too long since I read that book.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like Batman's holding the detonator, and Darkseid, you know, and if Darkseid doesn't
blow up the planet, right.
Yeah, and Darkseid looks at him and is basically like, you know what, you're the one motherfucker crazy enough to actually do this. With any of them, I'd laugh and go through with it, but you, I just don't fucking know.
That's in the movie. I don't remember if that's in the comic, though.
Yeah, see, I remember it in the book.
Oh, well then, yeah, it's in both.
Yeah, there we go. Problem solved. But yeah, I feel like that's just a mashup that needs to happen more often, because it's all intellect. It's not brute strength.
Do you think they're going to bring back, like, the Fourth World? Apocalypse is clearly back, but I mean, like, are they going to bring back that whole thing? Because I don't know if that's going to happen. They'd have to do like a storyline just for that.
I think they will, because I don't remember. Are you tracking with OMAC?
Well, OMAC's going to end, but I have been reading it up until the end.
Well, at the end issue 5, I think. There's and this is classic in setting up the Fourth World, because it's, you know, the same way Darkseid was revealed. Initially back in Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, you have a dark figure on a monitor, and we, you know, hardcore fans will know that it's Desaad, Darkseid's right hand man, but he's, you know, he mentioned something about getting the Genesis technology. So I might be reading too much into it. But that leads me to believe that there is definitely another side in this fight against Darkseid. Now, whether it means we'll get a whole nother planet and we'll have that out of it, but it's
clear
there's...
Have you heard about, like, a third wave of books that might... Because they seem to be doing these in themes. Like, the second wave of books is Earth 2-based books.
Yeah, well, you know what? I didn't even think about it, but that's a real good possibility. Because, I mean, it's clear they're building towards it with OMAC.
Oh, my God. You know, the whole... There could be so many... You could have a Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen book. You could have a Mr. Miracle book. You could have fourth world-based book. There could be so many... An Orion book.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's so... that
there,
whole
there's
world,
a lot of possibility and so many good writers that could write that stuff.
Oh yeah. I don't know. I trust DC to handle that right, because that is just I don't know what to say about it. The Fourth World is just one of the greatest comic book things in the comic book world, and that it's something that will only ever really work on the comic book page. Works okay on cartoons, but it works its best in a mainstream superhero
book.
They
touched on it in Smallville a little bit, like the last season.
Yeah, and you know what? I kind of enjoyed those parts of it.
It was a ton better than what was the two seasons before that? I'm trying to think. They basically did like a Death of Superman story.
Oh yeah, where they had. I kind of went in and out of Smallville, but I did jump kind of back in when they did the Geoff Johns Legion episode.
Oh, he actually did. He ended up doing a Legion episode
and the JSA episode too.
And he did. It was a movie. It was like a TV movie, because it was like 2 hours. It was 2 hours long. It was so good. Oh,
I know.
My God. And Stargirl was in it.
Geoff Johns needs to write more TV.
Well, he actually wrote part of the Green Lantern movie, and that was an abortion, so I don't know.
You know, I'm not as extreme in my hatred of the Green Lantern movie. I think they had elements there. They just needed to...
They did. Like, Ryan Reynolds was good. Blake Lively wasn't terrible near the end of the movie, but the story was so stupid, it was impossible to watch. You're like, oh, this is a really interesting plot point. I want to see more of this. And then they cut away to another story you don't care about, and then they try and make you care about that, and then as soon as you might, they cut away to the other story again.
See, I think that would have worked best if they had – because, I mean, they knew from the get-go they were going into this with the trilogy. So, like, they could have split that movie into two parts, done the first half on Earth. You know, oh, I've got this ring. What does it do? I have no idea. And the very end of that one, you got Sinestro showing up and taking him to space.
Well, they've already ruined it, because at the end of this movie, instead of having him gradually turn evil in the second movie, at the end of this movie, they just give him the yellow ring. And it's you didn't explain that at all. I guess we're going to start the next movie with him already being evil. It's just so badly executed.
Yeah, it needed a little more guidance, but it's one of those cases where you had so many people.
And that's exactly what it was. It wasn't even Geoff Johns writing it. There were like three or four other comic book writers on that movie along with him.
And this is why I have high hopes for the Avengers, because from the sounds of it, it's mostly Whedon.
Oh my God.
It is.
Did you see the Super Bowl commercial?
I did, and I did it without having to watch the Super Bowl, so everything worked out well.
Well, hey, I watched the Super Bowl too, but I didn't watch it with any commercials, so I don't know. But I ended up watching the commercials later, and no, this, oh my God, the trailer looks so good.
I have no words for how excited I am about this movie. Especially as, now, and this is another reason I'm not quick to harp on the Green Lantern movie. Now, all the starting with Thor, because that came out around my dad's birthday.
Yeah.
My dad and I, because he was the one who got me into comics, we went to the midnight showings of all the big nerd movies this summer, and you know, all the superhero movies and Planet of the Apes. So it's a little broader.
All the good movies, you mean?
Exactly. Anyway. Yeah, that's right. All the good movies that came out over the summer. So, and I know for a fact that we're going to go see the Avengers that same way. So between it being Joss Whedon and a midnight showing of it and a night out with my dad, who's been integral in my comic book, you know, my exposure to the comic book world, I am so goddamn excited for that movie.
It better not disappoint. I don't think it will. All the pieces have fallen into place in such a way, it's like, if you see it fail, it doesn't really make any sense why it would.
Exactly. It would have to be something like, the print that went out of the theater. Yeah, no, that was the one... That was the joke copy we edited together. No. The real one's here.
They'll send everybody the Wonder Woman pilot episode or something from NBC. We'll just watch that instead.
Right next to Joss Whedon's original script for the Wonder Woman movie.
Oh, it's so sad. I heard there's the new Justice League animated movie, Doom.
Oh, yeah,
The voice of Wonder Woman from Justice League and Justice League Unlimited is going to be reprising her role.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Thinking about that, yeah.
I know they brought, what's it?
They got the original Batman back, too, I think.
Yeah, Kevin Conroy, that's right. Also, Mr. Sunshine and Venture Brothers.
Oh, yeah?
Captain Sunshine, rather. Yeah, Do you watch Venture Brothers?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, when they brought Captain Sunshine in, that's Kevin Conroy voicing him, which adds
he
just
does
an
a lot of voices.
Oh, I know, but you know, the fact that he's voicing kind of a Superman, Batman analog just adds another layer of weird to that episode. Yeah.
Or something really creepy is going on with that. I hope they do more stuff with him.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Just being able to make fun of comic book superheroes, which they don't really do that much in Venture Brothers.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, I feel like they're running out of like weird sci-fi cartoons from the 60s to reference.
Maybe superheroes will be the next thing that becomes like a big deal.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But they'll find some weird twist on it. I'm just... Oh, and apparently that show got, I think, greenlit for 2 more seasons, at least.
Oh, jeez. I thought it had been canceled for a while, and then I heard that they were definitely doing another season.
No, they switched over to a different animation studio that's doing it all digital now.
Hmm.
So, and actually, that short that came out, the Behind the Music Shallow Gravy.
Oh, that was so good.
I enjoyed it, but at the same time, I'm a little... The animation's just a little different, so I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Okay, I think I know what you mean. Now that I'm thinking back about it, I noticed something was weird, but I didn't realize that they had just changed studios completely.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny. Parts of it look like, you know, the first runs of the character in that pilot. It's just some of the face shapes and everything. It's a little bizarre, but regardless, you know, it's more Venture Brothers. You can't go wrong with more Venture Brothers.
No, you cannot. But you can go wrong with more Rob Liefeld.
Oh yes, yes you can.
And I'm not a big hater of this dude. I mean,
I'm not either.
He's a classic artist, and he's been around forever. You give him respect because he was one of the Image founders and everything, and was also like integral in X-Men being amazing in the '90s. Mm-hmm. And Deadpool too. You know, you might not like Deadpool, but I personally do, and there is a big following for him. So he's done a lot. And currently, I am reading a comic of his that I enjoy with Kirkman, The Infinite, which is like this crazy time war with paradoxes and lots of big guns. It's really fun, yeah. And I heard
about that. Is that worth jumping on the trade when it comes out?
Oh, definitely. And the art's honestly like some of the better. Like when life felt good, you get some really fun action and guys wearing lots of backpacks and pouches. And this is a good Liefeld book. And Kirkman's writing it, so Liefeld doesn't have anything to do with the shitty story or anything. It's fun, and it feels like Kirkman's really writing this for Liefeld. So like, if he fails, it's his own fault. It's so Liefeld's fault. Yeah,
it's like the teacher writing up a separate lesson plan for the kid in the corner.
Yeah, and you know, maybe this kid's an autistic savant, but you have to just find that, you know, thing that like in the movie Shine with the kid who played the piano. You just have to find something that speaks to him. And for Liefeld, it's action, time travel, and lots of bags and pouches and guns.
as long as you don't tell him how many pouches he can put on someone.
Maybe invent a universe where feet and hands don't exist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know,
what's up?
Oh, no, I was just want to say, before we get into the, oh, God, why Liefeld, why, before we go further into that, I got to say, though, too, if you go on Twitter, no man on Twitter has more enthusiasm for comic books than Rob Liefeld, and I think...
He's such a nice guy, which is why it's funny how much hate he gets from people all the time, and... Mm-hmm. I don't hate him. I think that there are a lot of comics that, you know, he should maybe not have ever drawn, but I don't hate him or anything.
I don't dislike him as a human being.
If you see him at a convention, he's incredibly nice. And, like, you'll get I've never gotten a sketch by him, but I've known people at conventions I've gone to where they've gotten sketches and just talked about what a nice, amazing guy he is. Probably the nicest person in the comic industry.
Yeah, and I mean, again, like, he is super enthusiastic. Aside from art, you know, I've never heard anyone say, oh, he's a jerk. Although, you know, there is a bit of narcissism there. He did put out an action figure, the full title being Rob Liefeld's Shaft, Fully Flexible, 7 inches.
Which, Shaft from Youngblood, right?
I believe so.
That character looked like Liefeld. He just drew a character that looked like him with muscles.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen this character, but it's like this sort of tall white dude with like this orange fiery hair, and the dude might as well just said, I wish that when I was a kid my parents named me Shaft. because that's what the character sort of spoke to me as.
Oh, it's his Mary Sue.
It's the
self-insertion of a writer into their own story. I think the phrase comes from it was a parody of a Star Trek fan fiction parody. So it was a fan fiction, but it was parodying other fan fiction writers. I think this was either 80s or I don't know. My deep knowledge of the origins of this, but basically the writer, and again, I think this was a parody. So the fictional persona of the writer inserted herself into the story as a character, and her name was Mary Sue. So that's, if you ever hear that phrase, that's the writer saying, "Hey, I want to hang out with these people in this story." Bam,
I think nowadays people just call it meta. When a professional does it, it's just meta.
Yeah, well, yeah, like Grant Morrison has to have a bald character in every story, and
I think there's an artist who was doing that too. It might have been Philip Tan. He had these stories that were where he inserted like Marvel or DC editors into like these stories with people. It was very weird.
Huh.
And Stan Lee. I mean, Stan Lee in the 60s did it all the time.
Well, Stan Lee.
Oh, and Marv Wolfman did it too.
Well, Stan Lee is different because he is like more pop culture than human at this point.
It's true. I don't think he actually exists. It's just a hologram that makes appearances at every con simultaneously.
Here's what you can do. You put his name on a call sheet. He doesn't live anywhere. You put his name on a call sheet and put a script in a chair labeled Stan Lee, and he shows up.
And he'll just read it perfectly.
Exactly. He'll just appear and then disappear into the mists.
And also somehow understand everything and not be an old man about it. Until as soon as it ends, I'm sure he turns back into an old man.
Excelsior.
Yeah. But somehow he seems more aware than he should be for being 200 years old.
Yeah, I have this theory that people like him, Christopher Lee, God, there was one more on that list, and I think Iggy Pop's getting to that point. Chuck Norris, too, is on that list, who are actually robots. And they will never, ever, ever actually die, because they're so old and yet so with it still that it is defiance of some sort of laws of nature and God and science.
What the fuck is up with that Iggy Pop picture
in a dress?
In a dress? Why is that everywhere on the internet now?
I don't know, but it's awesome.
And it's like because pretty current. Like it looks like he does now.
Oh yeah, oh, God. Iggy Pop wins at everything. I don't care.
I don't condone that. I don't like it a lot. But anyway, back to Liefeld. I want to just look what he was
back
doing.
To other things we don't like.
I'm trying to not think about more things I don't like besides Iggy Pop is so Liefeld was doing a Hawk and Dove. That was one of the six books that got canceled. He was drawing it and maybe co-authoring it.
I think he was co-authoring it. If we can stop at Hawk and Dove real quick, that one panel in the most recent episode, in the most recent issue.
You're actually reading it?
No. It's just one that was floating around. Like somebody said something about. Somebody posted it on Tumblr, completely unrelated to why I tossed it around. Something about, and it was something positive, if I recall. But what I found awful about the panel was. Dove is in the foreground. Hawk saying something to her in the background, and Dove is in the foreground, facing the panel. You know, back turned to Hawk, and she's got her arms crossed. But it looks like she's kind of her hands are positioned, so it's like she's trying to tweak her own nipples behind her own elbows.
Oh, he always tries to hide the hands like that, and
it doesn't
work.
But even if you have someone crossing their arms normally, the best you're going to get is a couple fingers dangling out. I mean,
he can't draw. He knows he can't even do that.
Oh, my God.
So he jams them up the armpit or something, or into the boobs.
Really? And I mean, if you wanted to, you could have dropped her lower and had her hands and boobs completely out of it. But
maybe the writer was like, no. This girl's got to be standing, and her hands need to be somehow adjacent to the boobs. And so that was the solution.
Just tucked up in there.
Just right up in there. Looks like she's punching him.
It's cold out. She's keeping her hands warm.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was obviously a failure. I really didn't know a single person that was reading it past the first issue. I read it because I actually liked... I read the first issue because I liked how they were being treated in the whole Brightest Day storylines. Uh-huh. I was interested in the all the Brightest Day, Darkest Night stuff. I thought it was Blackest Night stuff. I thought it was good.
I
liked her as a character.
Uh-huh. I was curious about where she and Boston Brand would go.
Oh, yes. And that was still being touched on, too, in DC Comics Presents or something.
Yeah. Actually, that's right. They did play around with it a little bit. They did bring her into it a little bit.
They're technically dating, I think, in this continuity, too.
At the same time, I think Boston Brand's like, I think he's all over someone else in Justice League Dark.
Oh, I'm not reading that. Is that actually good to pick up? Because now that they're all like super cheap, like $2 issues on the digital front, I might actually pick it up.
See, I enjoyed it, but I'm not enjoying it as much as everyone else is. But I think mine's like, I feel like I'm doing like a bad fanboy thing. That I'm not liking it for bad fanboy reasons, and that is because I love Zatanna. I love that character on so many levels, and while it's sad that her solo title ended with the DC New, the way it ended was just the perfect ending for any comic book that was ending as a result of that sort of transition. But you know, before that, she was a strong female legacy character. She wasn't damaged. She wasn't mopey. She didn't have, well, I don't know. Daddy issues is kind of a broad term, but she wasn't, you know, oh God, my daddy hates me. No, she was living up to his legacy, but she was doing it in her own way. You know, it was one of those rare instances, too, of the female living up to the male legacy in superhero comics. Now, here, they haven't gone into her origin much, although if they do bring up back the Homo Magi, which they ended in, you know, a race they essentially killed off in the 70s Justice League comics, you know, if they bring it back, it's kind of worth it, because I just think that'd be a fun pocket that they could explore in modern times now, with technology being what it is. But there have just been a couple lines that it's, you know, Zatanna's running out of the wherever the Justice League is shacked up, and Batman's shouting out after, no, Zatanna, you're not strong enough. And I'm thinking, really? Because the Zatanna, you know, that I liked was strong and empowered, not damaged, because the writer thought that would make her an interesting character. Now, I love Milligan, but I feel like that's just kind of a cheap way to make a character, especially a female character, interesting.
Is he even going to be writing the book after, like, issue 8 or something?
And that's another thing.
I don't know if he was one of the guys who was being taken off the book.
Yeah, that's another thing. He's getting shuffled around. I forget who's taking on his title. I know, I'm pretty sure he's still sticking with Red Lanterns.
Oh, you know what? It was Stormwatch was he writing that?
That's right. No.
He's off Stormwatch now or something.
No, Paul Cornell's off Stormwatch. Oh, Pete Milligan's taking over Stormwatch. Although I'm not.
Well, maybe that'll get me to read, like, I don't know. No, I'm probably done with Stormwatch altogether until, like, somebody's like, oh, this trade is amazing. I think I'm done with the issues for that.
See, I've been enjoying it, but I have.
They're rebooting it again, though, basically.
Oh. See, I didn't really get much into it beforehand, so I only have like my knowledge of the Authority, which is on a brief note, I do like how Cornell is handling the courtship of Apollo and Midnighter. Everyone was, you know, I remember a lot of people getting upset. Oh well, they undid the relationship. Are they not going to be gay together? But Paul Cornell's making it kind of a cutesy, you know, a cutesy, like, very underplayed romance story.
Like, I've heard a lot of people being pissed off that a Martian Manhunter is barely playing a role in the whole thing, though, because he was touted as, like, being a member of the group and everything, and just, I've heard there's just not enough story about him.
There isn't, but I feel like they're saving him for something. Like,
well, I mean, if I've heard, like, they're going to pretty much completely redo the group after the next arc or something. So I don't know
exactly.
I don't know if Martian Manhunter is going to even be in it anymore. Yeah, it was like some solicit that was talking about another beginning or a new beginning.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
I mean, I don't know if they'll end up scrapping that, or if that just leads into a storyline with a bigger group with, like, the same people in it. I don't know.
I don't know. This group of characters is interesting, and I'm not sure which of them were created for, you know, this incarnation of the team, and I know a couple that were.
I don't know enough about Wildstorm, really.
Yeah, but regardless, I mean, I've been kind of enjoying it. It's one of those ones, though. I might after Cornell's off it, I might just stop, wait for the trades, and go back and double dip. So I have a complete trade collection on the shelf. Otherwise, it looks sloppy.
I wonder how well a lot of the Wildstorm books are doing, because that was one of the books that Liefeld's going on is the Grifter. I love that book. I don't know if he's going to be really good for it. And is he writing Grifter?
I'm not sure if that's because I know
he's writing and drawing Deathstroke, which I think that's probably the best fit for him out of any of the books.
Yeah, that if there's one book that screams 1995. Yeah. It is Deathstroke.
He basically, it was him and another writer that invented Deadpool.
Deadpool,
who is the direct like parody of Deathstroke. So
that's yeah, and I mean
now he's writing the character he was parodying. It's very interesting.
In Infinite Crisis, there was even like a kind of a toss off joke, a reference where I guess some. God, I forget the specifics, but I guess some Deadpool analog, they're fighting a bunch of Deathstrokes, and one of them dies or disappears, and he says something to the effect of, "For the last time, my name is Wade," or, you know, as he's dying or fading away, right. You know, the implication being that Deadpool, for a very brief time, was caught in the middle of Infinite Crisis.
Well, I mean, they made Deadpool as like a joke about the 90s. Uh-huh. I mean, like, I think he came around in like... 95, 96, around, like, just a little after, like, Deathstroke, you know, Teen Titans, new Teen Titans shit.
Huh.
And, so I think, I sort of think that he was, like, a critique of just the 90s in general, but, like, they just straight up stole Deathstroke, the Terminator.
Huh. See, I'm not super up to date on my Deadpool.
I didn't know a lot about Deathstroke. I just knew I was way more of a Marvel person anyway back then.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed Deadpool when he comes up, but I've just never really sat down and read his title.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know.
Well, I'm not reading. Maybe. I'm not reading Hawkman either, and that's the other Liefeld thing that's taken over. I don't know anything about that, and I probably don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Hawkman. I picked up the Geoff Johns trades, and to be fair, he took 70 years of the most convoluted superhero backstory and made them interesting and understandable in his introduction to the book. So, you know, I've kind of had a soft spot for Hawkman ever since then, and between that and Brightest Day. And so, you know, when I heard there was going to be a new Hawkman book, I got excited, and then Tony Daniel. Maybe I'll pick it up and trade and wait for the next writer.
Not every artist should be writing stuff. And I know I've read Tony Daniel's Batman. I was never impressed, so I had no interest in picking that up. Although, yeah. I feel like a hypocrite because I did pick up Tony Daniel's on Detective Comics for, like, the first arc.
Yeah, you gotta give some things a try.
I did. It was okay, but it was just like, this is the exact same stuff I was reading, like, in the early 2000s. This is really boring.
Yeah, that's what I hear a lot about his work. It's just, it's not awful, but it's not great. It's just a big bucket of okay.
Yeah, and it's funny, because, like, he starts off with, like, that first issue, like, it ends with somebody in some prison slicing off Joker's face and nailing it to a wall, and Joker escaping. So Joker's running around somewhere with no face on. And somehow that just didn't get me to keep reading it.
No, I can't imagine why it wouldn't.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea, just there was no real story behind it, and they never explained it.
Yeah, it seems like something, you know, just done for shock value. Oh,
that was pretty much it, yeah. And so, nothing to back it up. I don't understand how those kind of people still get work just because their book isn't canceled. Or even if it is, like, Liefeld, the only book he was working on for DC's new universe crap was Hawk and Dove. That gets canceled, and suddenly he's put on three new books? It doesn't make sense to me.
See, on the one hand, I can understand them maybe keeping him on one book because he's a name and people will poke. He's one of those artists, or, you know, in general, creatives who has a
following. Yeah.
Not only does he have a following, but the opinion is so split on him that people will pick up the book. People will pay money just to, out of morbid curiosity, because they know the name, they know the art style, and they want to see, okay, how bad is this?
Well, that apparently didn't save Hawk and Dove.
No,
but,
not at all.
But now they're giving him more power. Like, he's writing one or two of these series on his own and drawing them completely, and it just doesn't make sense to me. Especially on books that I enjoyed, Deathstroke was okay. Savage Shockman I never tried, but Grifter was something I was really enjoying. And so I just hope that him being on it's not going to ruin it.
Now, I say, you know, closer to... When did the second wave start in these in Weifeld's new books? End, like, May?
It was April or May, yeah.
So I think... Because I know things change a lot, especially with the DC new. Things change around, you know, within a week. So I say we find the books Liefeld's working on closer to the date of, and we take bets on how long he's on those titles.
I mean, so how long did it take for the first, like, cuts of stuff to happen? I think around issue number two, there were already announcements that artists and writers were dropped on books, and every single book was being taken over by Keith Giffen or something. So
you know what? I'm okay with Keith Giffen taking over things. He ran 52.
Yeah, he's like the... He's like the woodcock or something that they put to fill in the holes in the problematic areas of the New 52. They just sort of jam him in like every single problem they have.
That is the perfect analogy.
Was it Jenkins that was also getting some more work? I can't.
Jurgens.
Yeah.
That's right. And apparently, I got the two of them confused with, Booster Gold and Justice League International, but apparently they've never worked together.
Well, they were both on Booster Gold, the comic, I think, separately.
Yeah, I think they were, but at different times, right?
Yeah, like, one was working with Jeff Johns when he was on it and when it first started, and the other one took over when Jeff Johns and, I think, Dan Jurgens left, Keith Giffen took over.
That sounds about right, because I think Rick Remender even had like a brief run before it became Marvel exclusive.
There were a couple of one-shots from a bunch of different people.
Yeah, he had like two...
I can't believe I read that comic for so long, 50 issues or something.
And I'm surprised it went on that long. And honestly, I mean, what I've read so far and what little I know about the character from like 52... That it makes me really excited to see what Sci-Fi does with him when they do the Booster Gold TV show.
I'm excited about that. I'm also excited about the Green Arrow TV show, just because it's all the same producers and directors from Smallville.
Right, and so I think at the very least we will get 1 to 2 really good seasons of a superhero TV show.
That's true.
And maybe 8 crappy to subpar ones. Which, you know what, in terms of superhero TV shows, I'm okay with.
Well, you know what, I would say at the end, it's... At least for Smallville, for me, there were 5 great seasons and 5 blessed seasons. And it was like the blessed seasons were in the middle. Like, if you just watch like the first, you know, 2 seasons and then watch the last 3 seasons, it's a really great show. It's really, really good. And the fact is that I think it's going to always go down as a great show for me because I watched the last 3 seasons as they were coming out and I just enjoyed the hell out of those 3 years. Like, it was always good.
It is a TV show based on a comic book that lasted for 10 years.
It shouldn't have worked. I clearly remember when it was back when the Warner Brothers station was still around, WB.
Oh, the WB.
At the same time on UPN, they were at the exact same time slot. That was when Enterprise, the Star Trek show, was premiering too. So they were
They
were both competing against each other, and me and my dad had to on one of our TVs, like, use the VCR to record one show and then watch the other show as it was going on and then watch the next show right after that. And getting to be so annoying that we both just, like, called it quits and stopped watching Smallville for, like, the first couple seasons until we realized that Enterprise was terrible. And then I went back to watching Smallville, and he ended up just not watching that at all anymore. And It was really, really good after that for some reason. I enjoyed it. Even the shitty seasons where Lana Lang had magic powers and was a witch.
See, I'll be honest, I didn't track with it much. I enjoyed the little bits of it that I saw, but at the same time, I mean, and I can withstand a lot of camp. I love me some Zardoz and Rocky Horror Picture Show.
But it was just
too campy.
This felt like Xena or Hercules TV shows or something. That's the feel of it, but it was at a primetime slot.
Oh God! Oh, the Hangover episode. Oh my God, that hurts so bad. But then again, we get
the Hangover one. That was actually in the final season. That was a great episode.
Yeah, it was so bad, but so bad it's good.
Pretty
again,
much.
We had a cross-dressing Oliver Queen.
I don't think we've even seen that in the comics. Yeah, when they bring in, like, Blue Kryptonite on a TV show, like, who... How could you possibly... You bring in the Legion, you bring in the JSA, you bring in just everything that they brought in. They even make mentions of Bruce Wayne and Batman in certain parts. Like, it's in... Like, I think when it was, like, Lana Lang's last episode, she was like... I know all these, like, superheroes. I know about this Green Lantern guy, and I know about this billionaire in Gotham. And...
That was Chloe at the end.
Was it Chloe? You're right, yeah.
She was talking about all the superheroes she's encountered, yeah. That end speech was one of the things I really liked about the last episode.
Or that you get 10 full minutes of him in his costume just flying around. God, though.
Yeah.
I figured it would be, like, one shot at the very end, but they gave you, like, a whole scene of it.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Oh, yeah. And you know, the one episode where he goes into the future and pulls on the helicopter, the part of me that absolutely loves the I almost said Jeffrey Dahmer, not Richard Donner, the Richard Donner movie. You know, I there was a giant fangirl squeal when you see that helicopter go down.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I can understand why it stayed on and why people enjoyed it.
Yeah, as soon as they got rid of Kristen Crook.
Yeah, God damn it.
She was awful. She was really hot, but she was just so bad at it. She was so bad, and it was the only reason why you couldn't write a Lois Lane story was because of her.
She was a piece of wood.
Yep. And all she could do, she was like that terrible actress from Twilight, just didn't do anything.
Yeah. And hey, upward movement, she was in the Street Fighter movie.
I don't know if that's Chun-Li story. That's a side grade, not really an upgrade.
Yeah, it was sarcastic upgrade.
Oh, no. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
I did see that movie, though. It was really bad.
Wait, was it better than the Jean-Claude Van Damme one from the 90s?
God, no, that movie's awesome. He had Blanc in that movie.
That's the answer
that
I want.
That shit was amazing. Yeah, Christopher, oh my god, what's his name? From Back to the Future was M. Bison.
No, that wasn't Christopher Lloyd. Okay.
Was it Christopher Lloyd?
No. It looks a lot like him, and I thought that at first, but it was some other actor that I'd seen. I saw something from, like, I want to say like the 70s that he was in, and he was really good in that. But Street Fighter was his last movie. So you've got this, and it's kind of like Gene Kelly in Xanadu. Like, this is the movie they end their career with.
It's like or you know, the late Phil Hartman and Toy Soldiers.
Oh yeah. Oh god.
Or Little Soldiers, whatever it was called.
Oh god, that was his last movie.
That was his last movie before his coked up wife murdered him.
Oh. What a shame.
Yep.
Oh my god. You know what? On the plus side, at least his last movie wasn't Jingle All the Way.
That's true. This was after that.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger and the future Anakin Skywalker.
And he played a guy who was trying to sleep with Arnold Schwarzenegger's wife. Why do I even know that movie?
Because he is the best part of that movie.
Yeah. Well, no. Sinbad's the best part, but you know. It was Synergy. He was promoting his late night talk show, you know, that's still around.
Wait, Sinbad or Phil Hartman?
Sinbad. I wish Sinbad. Phil Hartman had a late night talk show back then.
Oh my god. Oh, I forgot Sinbad was a thing for a while.
Oh god, yeah. He was. Was it Warner Brothers that had him do their talk show? It was some network that was. It wasn't like network television, but it was still like, if you had an antenna on your TV, you could watch the a Sinbad show.
Oh god, I vaguely remember it happening, but at the same time I don't.
Hey, he outlasted Magic Johnson's TV show. So
didn't Tony Danza have a talk show too?
Probably. Everybody had a Chevy Chase had a talk show, and none of that matters.
I'd like to see Chevy Chase now do a talk show, but like
no,
more
he'd blow
like
it. He'd blow it. He really isn't funny because of himself anymore. It's just the community's that good.
Well, that you know what I think, but I think they've got him in the right vein where he's kind of almost making fun of himself.
Oh shit!
Where he's like, what's going on?
You're breaking up. I think we need to log back in.
Okay. Give me one second. Hello.
Is it better?
It sounds fine to me. Does it sound better to you?
Yeah, it sounds a little better. Good.
Okay. Good to know. Good to know. Okay. All right. And we're all connected in the back. Everything is good to go.
Good. All right. So did you hear about the sales from this January compared to last year's January?
For all comic books?
For direct market sales through Diamond.
No, I did not.
It was up 27.5% from a year ago.
Holy crap!
Which is insane. Now, that's not saying that, like, there's no, it's not like the medium of the entire year. This is just this January compared to last January.
No,
and apparently, somebody explained this to me, the sales in January are usually really bad, where the December sales are pretty high up, the January sales peter out usually.
Okay, now, the question I want to ask before I jump to any conclusions, is this because of the DC New?
Well, it's January, though. That's the thing. Who knows if it... DC was obviously... DC sold more books this month. But Marvel actually made more money. So they're both very neck and neck.
Huh.
Because Marvel's price point is $4 a book, where DC is $3 a book. DC sells a bunch more books, but Marvel still makes a lot more money. Because... people will still buy a lot of Marvel books. They're not buying as much as DC, but they make enough money.
Got it. And again, this is only direct market. This isn't taking into account digital sales.
No, correct? Like that's I talked about the digital stuff separately. They don't give any numbers for that stuff. This Diamond does this on their own. The company, each company has to decide to give out their numbers for digital. And for some reason, DC has been doing it every month, but nobody else has really been doing it.
Huh.
The Comixology doesn't like to talk about it. For some reason, and Marvel doesn't really talk about their stuff. Dark Horse might start talking about their stuff, but they've only been out for like a couple of months now.
Well, I feel like, and I think we touched on this last time, I'm not sure if it carried through the recording, but I completely misspoke there. Either Dynamite or Boom, whichever one has the darkness. Top Cow.
I was going to say that's neither of them. That's Witchblade's territory. That's Top Cow.
Yeah, that's right. No, see, I'm for orders, because I know they made a big sales announcement, but that's like their whole packaging thing.
They're big into digital. I think the Artifact series, which is like their crossover from all the books, I think that's digital only now or something. I mean, it's cheaper digital. There's something about what Top Cow's doing digitally.
See, and I like how all the smaller publishers are adapting to.
Archaea's trades are all digital now. I read the Jim Henson book, Tale of Sound from Archaea, digital.
Oh, how is that?
Oh, it's amazing. Like that dude, I can't even think of his name yet because he's so new, the artist for that book. I think it's something Ramon. Dude's amazing. He is going to be one of the biggest stars in the next couple of years. He's going to be amazing.
I am so excited to read that because I heard about it like a year ago, and ever since then, it's just been kind of sitting on my Amazon wish list.
It's such a surreal journey. It's amazing.
Could you have imagined it done with puppets? Like a Jim Henson?
It wouldn't have been done with puppets. This was clearly a live-action movie. Like, I've read excerpts from the script, and they actually, parts of the book, like the background, the border will be like, it looks like parts of the script where like the page is tearing apart.
Really?
It's so well done. Oh. And it's such a surreal, weird journey that, like, if I read, I don't know, this guy is a genius because he was able to read that insane journey of a script and actually make something out of it. Not saying it's completely coherent, but I feel like he definitely understood what Jim Henson was trying to do.
That's amazing. I got to run out and get this weekend then.
Like, this is already like such a good start to the year because this book exists.
Oh man, I am excited. What was the price point in digital?
It's it was like $12 maybe, $14, something around that.
And see and that's
probably about the same
thing
as the actual trade was.
Well, the actual trade I think is either 20 or 24. Meanwhile, I feel like that digital price, that's like the same as Amazon's price, right around there. So what they, even though it's the same as Amazon, what the reader gets in the digital version is the instant gratification. They say, I want this, and instead of waiting for the free shipping, they get it now.
I would still argue that cheaper is the way you should go for digital. I don't know if you really should charge for convenience, because it's also convenience for the distributor. So for that, you should the two convenience charges should be canceled out, because the distributor, the publisher, everybody is, you know, making this product for less money because they don't have to print it. And then and from one file, they can keep pumping out a version to give everybody.
Oh, right. No, I'm not. I can't, believe me, I'm not arguing for that. I'm just pointing out that, you know, they've kind of got a one up on Amazon there.
I suppose, but if I want a hard trade, it's sad to say, but I would still go to Amazon to order a trade than I would to go to a local comic book store, just because the price point is most of the time it's actually better than even digital.
Oh, right. And well, I mean, what I was going to kind of get into there is, I mean, I feel like a lot of people are panicking because they feel like the direct market's going to disappear. And I think I feel like the way the comic books, the sequential art medium, and that business is structured, the shops that are going to disappear are the ones that are like comic books and baseball cards. There you go. But the ones that actually care, the ones that carry indie books, they're going to survive the way record shops have. Like, you know,
it doesn't have anything to do with even what you carry. It's the way you carry it.
Well,
because like, you do have the right to charge $4 for a book. I actually believe that. You have the right. In digital, I don't think you do. But if that's how you value the hard copy of a book, and people want to pay for a hard copy, then they get that, and you market it like that. You're charging more because it is a physical book that you don't want to toss out.
Exactly. And, I mean, and the reason, well, that you touched on something there, it's not what they carry, but how they carry it. I mean the shop experience is one thing, but again, like the music market, if someone wants a physical copy of something that has, you know, the largest format of it, that has the quality there, and is something you're going to invest serious money in, but you're going to revisit, you're going to be proud of it, you're going to put it in a place of honor in your home, that's how comic shops are going to survive. I mean, I'm a shelf porn junkie. I love the version that has the hardest cover, the slip cases, the whole nine yards, all of that.
Well,
I'm
not a big fan of the slip cases or the dust covers or all that.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, like, I generally take them off, and I really love a hardcover that has an awesome, like, sort of etching or something underneath the slip case.
Oh, see, I mean, the
Grant Morrison hardcover Swamp Thing books. I mean, the Alan Moore hardcover Swamp Thing books. They look beautiful, and I take all the covers off. And
really?
it's just like these Swamp Thing etchings, and like it says Swamp Thing in like a gold type or something in the top, and that's it. And the rest is just a big green book.
I'll be honest, I've got two of those in hardcover sitting on my shelf right now, and I did not take the dust jackets off. So after we're done here, I may have to take a look.
You look underneath them. Like, not all of them are like that. Some of them are really boring. I have like four now of the series. I can't remember how many there are total, but I'm trying to get them all.
There's like six out now, I think.
And I think they're still coming out.
Yeah, I did not realize
for so long.
Yeah, I didn't realize how long he was on that damn book.
I mean, like, I would collect all of his old superhero stuff. I want the and maybe it's out now, but the last time I looked, it wasn't there. I want a hardcover edition of his Captain Britain.
Ooh.
I would really. Yep. I read that in trade. I think I got it from my library years ago, and I read it and I loved it. It was so cool, and it was sort of the beginning of the multiverse. Was that book?
That's what I've heard, and that's kind of why I want to go back and check it out. So I don't know.
I think the first mention of Marvel's 616 universe was in that book.
That's right, and he, if I recall correctly, he even tossed it off as, he had reasoning for that number, but for the most part just kind of tossed it off as like a weird intellectual joke.
And yeah, people ask him about it, it's like, how do you feel about it? He's like, oh, I don't give a shit. I wasn't trying to create a multiverse, I just made up the name for the universe.
I just put in a number there that was arbitrary, because I am Alan Moore.
Exactly, I mean, like, and he's such a dick about it, but there you go.
He's not a dick. He's just a grumpy old man. It happens.
But he was a grumpy. He's been a grumpy old man for 40 years.
I don't know. There was something. God, what am I thinking of? One of his short stories that's, God, just kind of lingers out is like there. That tells me that there is a heart and soul somewhere.
Was it Lost Girls? Because I don't know. That really tells you.
No.
I don't know if making a pedophile pornography is really.
That's a different kind of heart and soul.
I mean, it's a good book, but my God, do I feel dirty when I read it.
I still have not read it. I'm saving that for when I move out of my parents' place and I don't ever have to explain it ever.
I mean, like, I feel like it's the same thing for any adult to his kids. Like, how can you, he writes some amazing, amazing shit that you just could never have around your house.
Yeah.
So bad. Just sort of like, on my, Amazon wishlist, I put on, there's a Bruce Timm book where he just draws women. And,
oh, I've seen some of his pinups. Yeah.
And, yeah. It's just a book of his pinups. And a lot of them are, you know, all, like, just, like, new drawings he does. And he has, like, ones of some DC characters, too, I think. But it's just, his style is so good. And I want that book so badly.
Oh, my God.
It's like an artist edition for just Bruce Timm drawings.
Now, I know he absolutely does not have to do a mainstream comic book ever. But if he could do, like, one limited series, like, now, I would buy it in every format available.
I don't know what he's up to anymore. He probably just goes to, like, those conventions and draws, and that's all he ever does anymore. He does, like, his art just, like, one sketch will sell for $500 anyway.
Oh,
who the hell cares?
He drew a stick figure on a napkin and put little bat ears on it.
If you sign up with Bruce Timm, like, it's automatically worth a shit ton of money.
And yet he deserves it. He's worked
hard. He does. Where would we be in a world of, like, no, half the people who know about Batman wouldn't know about him.
Yeah, well, I feel like you're right. That show was huge in terms of superhero cartoons.
Like, nobody else was reading comics with me when I was a kid. I had a few friends who read X-Men, but I don't think anybody was reading DC who was my age back when that cartoon was out, but everybody watched that cartoon.
Oh, yeah, my entire background of, you know, the DC universe comes from that cartoon, that, you know, the Superman cartoon, not as much the Justice League cartoon, but yeah, like, I mean...
Well, I mean, like, I was already, like, 17 or 18 when the Justice League cartoon came out. I was watching it, but it didn't really affect me a whole lot. Like, it wasn't going to form me to any decisions.
Yeah, see, I didn't have cable at that point in time, so I missed out on a lot of that. It was a sad, dark time.
I downloaded it all. That was around the time that I knew completely about, like, BitTorrent, so...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, 17, 18. Yeah, junior, senior year of high school. I don't... Yep. Why didn't I download that then? Huh.
I have no idea.
Things I could have been doing with my time.
Yep.
Could have been studying, too, but meh. Meh. Lake Braddock High School.
I don't think I studied. I don't remember.
If you don't remember, you probably didn't.
Let's not think about that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But
so,
I was going to say, one of the things we could think about, that's... one second.
God damn it, Eddie.
Okay. But take two. But what we could talk about instead of the dark times of Lake Braddock, is shiny, happy things that could have been, that could have gone right in the past.
What, like comic book movies?
Like comic book movies, because this sounds so natural and unrehearsed and unplanned.
Subway'd.
Exactly. Incidentally, it took me a really long time to figure out the way Segway was actually spelled. With a U-E, not W-A-Y.
Not like the company that makes the scooters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What was I even going to say? Because I've been reading Jonah Hex lately. I've been kind of picking up those collected editions, and I'll be damned if I don't love me a good Western. I took a class on Westerns in specifically on revisionist Westerns. So, the ones that were trying to
all of them revisionist. I mean, how many of them are telling the real story of The Searchers and some James stuff.
Searchers is in this category, but not necessarily the, you know, we're going to whitewash history. Yeah, the white guys were good. The slaves loved it. Not that sort of revisionist.
Oh, okay.
But the ones that said, huh, there are a lot of movies that whitewash the past. Let's see what, and, you know, it's all about fighting the Indians. The ones that tried to be not John Wayne movies, like The Searchers. Even though he was in it, but it wasn't the typical John Wayne movie.
What are you talking about? You know? He was an asshole, he was unapologetic, and he was racist. That was a John Wayne movie. That was a complete John Wayne
Those points were in it, but there was more to it.
He shot off some guy's eyeballs so that he couldn't go to the afterlife. That was...
That's just badass.
I mean, like, I'm just saying, like, I saw some documentary sort of recently on Netflix called Real Engine, and it was about just Indians in film, and they used... And just how unfairly they're treated with stereotypes, and they use the Searchers as one of the white man that hates the Indians stereotype.
Didn't a white guy play Scar? Or I think the guy's name was Scar, right?
Oh yeah. It was played by an Italian dude. I can't remember his
right.
name. Yeah, he was a pretty big actor back then, but I can't remember who it was. I mean, it was one of those classic Ford westerns, really.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
It was a revisionist thing. It was. I would say that Jonah Hex sort of fits in that style.
It does, and well, the comic book started coming out in that same period. So, I mean, you could definitely count Jonah Hex amongst those books, amongst that era.
What an interesting character too, compared to other like a disfigured cowboy hero.
Right. He wasn't, John Wayne. I mean, you're not aside from a Rooster Cogburn's eye patch, you're not going to mess with John Wayne's face. It's a face.
Yeah.
It's recognizable.
It's true. Eye patch doesn't disfigure, really.
Exactly.
You don't
exactly.
have to see the eyeball, and you're not really scared.
It just makes it the John Wayne movie where he's wearing an eye patch.
Pretty much.
I was talking to somebody who was big into Jonah Hex, to the point where he knew, when it became, went from Jonah Hex to Hex, which was Jonah Hex in the future in space.
I remember that shit.
I really want to pick up a full run of that on eBay.
I've never actually read it, but I remember people talking about that. It was so stupid.
Oh, but it's so stupid. It begs to be read.
Maybe.
But apparently, now I don't know whether this was him driving this wagon or not, but Clint Eastwood was going to be in a Jonah Hex movie. That was one of those things that just kept getting shelved and reshelved and never wound up happening.
Yeah.
But theoretically, though, I still would I would watch Clint Eastwood in a movie that was supposed to be Jonah Hex's End of Days.
Old man Jonah Hex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, they could totally do it. But part of what brings this up, too, in addition to Jonah Hex, is recently it came out that David Bowie's ex-wife, kind of on a whim, bought the rights back in the 70s to The Black Widow and Daredevil. Have you heard about that?
Wait a minute. How can she have the rights to the... I mean, does Disney have to pay her?
I'm not sure how...
Are those just the movie rights?
It might have been the movie or TV rights. All I know is she had the rights for a while, and they were going to either do a movie or TV series where Angela Bowie played the Black Widow, and an actor friend of theirs, who was I bring this up because it explains the pictures a little better. A black friend of theirs to play Daredevil, which is weird because it adds some sort of weird racial
racist. You're a racist. Why'd you bring that up? You could just said that. You could just said they brought in an actor who likes rap music and fried chicken, and I've been like, okay, they're really getting in the ethnic crowd. You had to say black. Racist.
I know. I'm just a Southern boy. What can I say? No, but
could this Daredevil swim? I don't know if the regular white one could swim.
Fuck Hell's Kitchen.
I don't know if you should swim when you're blind.
That might not be good. Him and his homeboy.
Well, now that everybody thinks that you're racist, keep going.
Yeah, and I'm just gonna keep digging that hole further. But anyway, I mean, it does add that almost a negative racial angle to it when you see a black man in a devil outfit, but there are all sorts of pictures of Angela Bowie dressed up
as like a big fat white kingpin that he takes down. That'd be a really good series. Actually, I would love to see that series.
It'd be
like a blaxploitation Daredevil.
Exactly. I almost think that's what they were going for. But it was one of those ones that makes you think. What if this would have happened? And I think it could have worked. I think they could have gotten that together, and I think it could have actually been reasonable. If anything, so bad it's good. I don't know. You can only say so much about something that didn't actually happen, and all you've got is pictures.
Yeah, it's true.
And I mean, a few years ago, there was, I think it was in Wizard, Mark Millar did this article for April Fool's about a Orson Welles Batman movie that never got made. And, you know,
God, that never got made.
I don't know. I think that could have been interesting. And later was revealed as a hoax, and all the internet people who claimed to know about it, you know, even though it wasn't a real thing, just kind of quietly retreated to the back alleys of, oh God, what is that one forum that,
4chan?
4chan, there we are. Oh, okay. Yeah, they all retreated to 4chan and, did things
something
like...
Something awful? I don't know.
Yeah, oh yeah, the something awful forum goons.
Yeah.
But,
oh boy, I know, that can be tough.
Oh yeah. But, I would have liked to see that. I don't know.
So I guess I'm a cynic. I wouldn't have liked to see any of that.
Unless
you really make it over the top and insane, and that wouldn't have been... It would have just been an incredibly boring Batman movie, I feel like.
I think it would have had potential. But at the same time, I mean, again, we're speculating about this. We've only got a hoax article to go on. But at the same time, it's endlessly fascinating because...
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have, like, actors lined up for it. Or you just have... He'll be producing or directing it or something. Who knows?
Exactly. Mark Millar had, like, in the article, like, you know, his Orson Welles' fake plans for the Batman.
Oh, was this a joke made by Mark Millar?
Yeah. It was an April Fool's joke where he got the internet all riled up over something that actually wasn't real. You know, half the internet was, oh my God, this is exciting. This was a thing. The other half was, oh yeah, I totally knew about it. Yeah. And there was a small minority that was like, what? This is fake. But,
Dick move.
I don't know. I thought it was pretty clever.
What Mark Millar is saying? No, Mark Millar is not clever. He's
that's the only, I was about to say, that's the only time you'll ever hear me say. And that was pretty clever about Mark Millar.
Have you read some of the scripts that he's done? I think there was a script for, it might have been Kick-Ass or something. He sent it to, yeah, I think it was Kick-Ass because I remember it was Romita Jr. was talking about it. A script that just said on like a blank page, do a cool fight scene.
Wow.
And Romita's an artist who could do that. But like, that's just the style that's Mark Millar's style. He's so not interested in the little details. All he cares about is if there's a lot of fucking and blood and guts.
He's the Michael Bay of comic books.
Yeah, he basically says explode or something on a page, and then it's like, what am I supposed to make explode? What do you want? Just make it all explode.
He's such
like a hack, but my God, like if he keeps getting paired up with these amazing artists, I'm gonna keep reading. Like the next artist he's working with is Frank Quitely, I think.
Oh God, yeah, I saw that. I'm like, damn it, I'm gonna have to buy this.
You're gonna fucking read it, and it's just because he'll be so vague in his scripts that the artists basically make the book.
At the same time, though, I feel like that's how Quitely's collaborations with Morrison go, because I mean they've worked together so much.
That book was so detailed, though. You think it was really just Quitely being that detailed of an artist? I mean, it was late a lot.
All Star Superman?
Yeah. When they were talking about, or were you talking about Batman and Robin?
Oh, no, I'm talking about, like, everything they've done together. They worked together a lot, so
Did they do We Three? Was that them together? Okay. Yeah, they do work together a lot. Damn.
The first thing they did together was Flex Mentallo, which was either late 80s or early 90s, so, I mean, they've been working together.
I've never even read that, yeah.
I haven't either, but the deluxe edition's coming out soon. It's been out of print for a while, apparently, so... So they're re-releasing it. But, I mean, so they've been working together for a while. So I think if there's one artist that can handle a mad Scotsman giving very vague directions,
yeah.
I think it's Frank Quitely.
I mean, like, Romita did an unbelievable job on Kick-Ass, and I'm reading the second... second volume is almost done now, and I've been reading it in issues. It's so good. Just art alone, I'm happy I own these issues.
See, I'll be honest, I did not... really enjoy Kick-Ass either in the comic book or the movie. I mean, the movie had its moments.
The movie was fun, but it's not near... I don't know. I really enjoy the comic so much.
Oh, I see. It didn't do anything for me. Excite and delight me.
Yeah.
But the Romita art was a freaking amazing.
We're going to do another movie. And I remember, I think there was an interview when the first book had come out, and they are already playing on the movie. They asked, he said in some interview that it was a, Mark Miller said, it was a dream of his to make a movie in which a gigantic fight breaks out in Times Square. And oh, people God. Just murder each other. And when I started reading the I think it was the first issue of Kick-Ass Volume 2, this was like almost a year after he had that interview, it just does a look into the future on the first page, and it's just people killing each other in Times Square.
Oh, God.
And I was like, this is good. I'm sure that he's already optioned this into a movie. And I think by the third issue, there was already people talking about the movie being made. And I was like,
oh, God.
Well, here you go. I guess everything that Mark Miller wishes gets to come true.
Mark Miller is like a kid who has discovered that the world is his action figure toy box.
Nobody says no to him. That's what it feels like.
Oh, God. I am curious about what... Well, you know who would say no to him? Grant Morrison. Because they absolutely hate each other.
Well, they never really work together. I mean, like, you know, if they're two writers and they're two hard-headed guys, they're never going to work together on a
two
project.
Hard-headed yeah. Scotsmen, mind you.
Oh, God.
But they were... Well, there was some quote in a recent interview with Grant Morrison. There was something about if you ran into... What would you do if you ran into Mark Miller? And he's like... He said something, but I hope when I do run into him, I'm moving at 600 miles an hour or something like that.
I mean, just, like they couldn't really... be more opposite writers. Grant Morrison is clearly obsessed with detail. Seems to, in his stories all seem to have this one theme that he really cares about living creatures, which I am positive that Mark Miller doesn't care about anything that's alive.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean,
his love for murder and violence in all his comics.
I know they both worked on, kind of spinning out of Morrison's JLA run, the Aztec. I still haven't read it, but there was a character that came out of that named Aztec that Miller's name is attached to.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. It might have been something, you know, their whole animosity towards one another could be something as a result of that, but...
Is Miller like tied to like Marvel still, or what's going on? I don't even know what's going on with him anymore. His creator owned stuff isn't even under Icon anymore, I don't think.
Oh really? I thought it was Kick-Ass 2 is an Icon?
No, Kick-Ass 2 is, but that's it. All of his other books like Superior and I think his Frank Quitely book, I think they're gonna be under Miller World.
Oh wow. See, I thought Superior was Icon too. Oh no, wait, Nemesis was Icon.
Nemesis was Icon and Superior wasn't. Well, like Nemesis was Icon and Miller World, and Kick-Ass Volume 2 is Icon and Miller World. I think Kick-Ass is just owned by Marvel because of that.
Well,
or at least they have the right to produce it.
It might have something to do with the film. That might be part of it.
But for some reason his last two books were both Icon and Miller World, and then his book after that was just Miller World, and I think everything after that, it's just like Kirkman slowly moving all his books over to
Shadowline.
To his own, like, you know, thing, like Witch Doctor and all that other stuff.
Uh-huh.
Like, all these creators are making their own publishers now. It's like rap artists.
Oh, God. Yeah, and you know what? I feel like unlike the rap music game, to sound as white as possible,
mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a lot of self-censorship, so you're not going... I mean, you've already... It's comics, it's the internet, you've already got a lot of people clamoring, saying, hey... You know, me included, I'm roping myself in as one of these people, saying, hey, look at me, I'm trying to start up, look at me, I'm good, I promise you'll enjoy what I make, I swear. And, you know, you got those people on street corners saying, hey, listen to my demo CD, I'm good, I promise I can rap. So I mean, it's the same thing, but I feel like in the comics industry, it's not as...
Well, I think Kirkman's
as loud as obnoxious.
Kirkman's new company is pretty much made to pick up people like you who are just screaming to be heard. But I don't know. I don't know if Miller's is just going to be made to pick up women or something.
Yeah, well,
baby, I bet you could write a comic for me.
It's
does that work? I don't know if that works.
It might. I mean, it depends on the woman. But
I have my own publishing company. Why don't you wiggle for me and write some comics?
Yeah.
That's how I believe Mark Miller talks to women.
I'm just thinking of a whole exchange that gets his magazine Clint and the Clitoris confused.
What?
I can just imagine some sort of exchange between him and a young lady about finding the Clint.
Mm.
But But I, you know what, I feel like that might be why he's not as attached to Marvel or even doing mainstream things. Because, I mean, he's got that magazine. He's trying. He's basically
maybe
trying.
Maybe he's focused on that now. Yeah.
And because I mean, he's got. Well, yeah, he's trying to basically reinvent 2000 AD. But because he's a name, he can do that.
I can't believe it's 2000. Kind of, that's, I guess that's the whole joke of 2000 AD. But the fact that the magazine's around.
It went on past 2000.
They named it 2000 AD because when it started, the average lifespan of a comic magazine was like 10 years or so, and I think they made it in 1990. So they're like, it will end in 2000, and it didn't.
Oh no! I thought it was a lot older than that.
Was it? Well, whatever it was, like the lifespan of it was supposed to be, it was going to end in 2000 because that's just that was the average lifespan of those magazines back then, or something like that.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, on one level, because they've defied the odds. On the other, you know,
it's an anthology magazine. I don't know when you can actually end those. Like I read the newest issue. It was like a bunch of like Judge Dredd something or other. It's like some multiverse with Judge Dredds.
Oh wow!
I didn't even understand.
That sounds insane and dangerous.
It was weird. It was good, but yeah, not much else really to it. I picked it up because I just randomly saw it and I hadn't read 2000 AD in years.
I still haven't read any. I've been meaning to. I've been slowly getting into more Euro comics. I mean, I've got a bunch of I've got some Tank Girl set aside, but I just don't know where to start.
Great. Although I think the newest stuff was actually like an American indie run of it.
Well, isn't one of the guys in the Gorillas behind?
It was one of the original creators, but I don't know if he has anything to do with Tank Girl anymore.
Gotcha. Because I was about to say, like, you know, his success in the music industry might have had something to do with the publishing, but who knows?
I just remember seeing it like maybe 3 or 4 years ago on the shelves. I didn't pick it up. I was really over Tank Girl by then. Not really into like the punk rock, you know, post-apocalyptic comics anymore.
Well, and we already know from earlier in this conversation that you've got some sort of vendetta against Iggy Pop.
Well, I don't know. You know, I just, you know, wish he would put a shirt on. That's all I wish.
Yeah, but
I
mean,
I did love his appearance in go back to the Venture Brothers. That was amazing to have him there. He had like a Kamehameha or something. Wasn't that supposed to be Iggy Pop?
Yeah, Iggy Pop and Klaus Nomi.
Klaus Nomi, yeah, with the plastic motherfucking bow tie.
Oh my god, that was like one of the best like Bowie nerd pulls.
It's just something that like you don't expect because that series is not really pulling in David Bowie people, as far as I can tell.
I think there's a lot of overlap between a nerd and David Bowie fan.
Okay, yeah.
you know, Ziggy Stardust, space, aliens, all that.
And the argument at the end is like, you're such a poser. Changes was a best of album.
I know. Oh my god.
That was such a great line.
I laughed so hard because I remember seeing that. I kind of fell into all my dad's records, and I was going through, and when I first got into Bowie, I was so excited. Oh, it's another Bowie record. Oh, this one has all the ones I like on it. Oh god, it's a best of.
Yeah,
I feel ashamed for liking this one the best.
Hey, I play that album, you know, pretty often just because then I don't have to make a playlist of the songs I like.
Good point. Yeah. Good point. And by, you know, you get to skip some of the later, iffier Bowie.
Yeah, or, you know, I don't like to dance Bowie. Stop singing about dancing.
Let's dance.
I don't know, it's a very popular song now, but you know, I just don't like it.
But we can all still love Bowie, even though he's sworn off music, which is a shame.
Yeah, he's sworn off a lot of things that I think he's gone back on.
Like dudes?
No, I was gonna say women.
Yeah,
I would think that would be more surprising to people.
Yeah.
Like the dudes are like, oh yeah, duh. Duh.
At the same time, though, the woman he's with now looks just as alien and as androgynous as he does.
Well, good. He's found somebody for him. Sexuality is not a this or that. It's a scale, and you can go up or down it, and women are at the bottom. I don't know.
It's a scale from woman to Ziggy Stardust.
That's exactly how I rate them. Wait, so both ends are women? I'm confused. It's a weird scale. Are men in the middle? Or... I like that scale.
He's not a woman. He's an alligator. He's a mama papa coming for you. He's a space invader. He'll be a rock and roll. And you know what? Do you want me to just recite
That's not the direction I wanted this to go in at all.
No, but I took it there because I love me some Bowie.
Oh, wait, shit. There was something else I wanted to talk about that I completely forgot about. And this is, I don't know why, but I've just been on an insane manga kick. And I think I do sort of know why. It's because Shonen Jump has gone completely digital with their new magazine, Weekly Shonen Jump Alpha. And it's on my iPad, and it's on my computer, and now I can read that shit anywhere. They've done some interesting stuff that's completely different than the American comics. Now, I've talked about it before.
Uh-huh.
It's basically... What?
Oh, no, there's no more print Shonen Jump?
It actually ends in April, I think. No more print Shonen Jump. Yeah. They aren't even doing that in Japan. In Japan, they're still going to have the print magazine, but they're trying to go more digital, too.
That is ballsy.
They actually have, like, you have to download a manga reader off of the Japanese website, and you read your manga in this proprietary application that they make you download. But in America, we just read it through the browser, which is nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, basically, the comic had, like, six or... Oh, no, it had five comics it was following from Shonen Jump, and it was about, I would say, a year or two behind Japan in where they were with their comics, like Bleach and Naruto and Katekiyo Hitman Reborn and all these other books that they were very far behind on.
I kind of track a little bit with the manga news when it pops up, but if I recall, at least one of those two, like, very long-running series, it's either... Or three of them. God, now I can't remember. It's either Bleach, Naruto, or One Piece are ending soon.
Bleach is ending. Okay. One Piece just started its final arc, but I think it's going to be an epically long arc, like maybe 10 more years. Like, it's basically like, because just the way that One Piece arcs go, I'm not a big fan of One Piece, but like I've been starting to read it again just because I'm trying to read everything in Shonen Jump.
Gotcha.
Naruto, Kishimoto, the mangaka for that, has said that they are nearing the climax. Now, whatever that means, like, I just read this, like, in an interview. Like, I don't know if that means that that's the final arc is the climax or what, but, like, you can tell that they are nearing something pretty epic that they've been building to for, like, the last, like, entire series, really. Like, the whole series been building to this thing in Naruto. So it's a pretty good series. But the way that, like, they were, like, years behind in some of the series, they were, like, a year behind in, like, some of the more major ones, and they were trying to catch up with trades. And they were doing a pretty good job of it, and they've been double shipping trades, like, two a month for a couple of months trying to catch up. And now, I guess the sort of reason behind it is that the digital version is only 2 weeks behind Japan.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty epic, but because of that, people who were trying to read it in the trade, or in the magazine that was being shipped to them, were nowhere near understanding what was going on when last week the first issue of Weekly Shonen Jump Alpha came out online. Nobody knew what the fuck was going on. I think a few of them started off in new arcs. Like, there's a really good comic I like called Toriko, and it's all about this muscle-bound dude who is actually a chef, but like he lives in this world where monsters are your food, and you have to murder these giant monsters, and you're called like a gourmet, but you're really just like a bounty hunter. It's a really cool like idea, and you just these guys travel around the world murdering these giant monsters and fighting each other so they can have the best menu, and that's a really fun one. That started off on a completely new arc, so it's actually pretty good. But, like, you know, a few of them, like Naruto and Bleach, just drop you right in the middle. And if you weren't reading the illegal scanlation sites online, you have no idea what you're doing. So what it feels like is, and the trades aren't anywhere near there either. They're usually, like, right now, like, Naruto's, like, two or three trades behind where the storyline is. And so, same thing with Bleach, same thing with Toriko is, like, one or two trades behind. And a few of these books, I don't even know where they're at because I wasn't reading them online to begin with. And it's forcing me and other people, I think, to go to these illegal scanlation sites and catch up so that they can pay for it and understand what's going on. And I don't know if they're going to try and fix this soon by releasing a ton of trades for every series or what. But
that was going to be my follow-up, if there was any word on how they're going to rectify this. Because, I mean, I'm sure there's somebody in those offices that are saying, wait a second, we gooned up somehow.
And the trades are so cheap, everybody would be willing to pay for them. They're 120 pages for if you buy it digitally, it's $5.
You can't go wrong with that price point.
It's absurd. Like, if you buy them physically, I think they're $7 for the normal ones, and for like some of the signature stuff, like the more adult comics are like $8 or $9, like Excel Saga or something. But I mean, it's just, it's such a good price point, and I'm loving the shit out of it. They just, the last 2 weeks, they were doing an interview, an extra interview in the back of it with Kishimoto from the writer of Naruto, and just, it was really interesting. And if they keep coming out with good extra stuff like this, where I can wake up in the morning, turn on my iPad, read the paper, and then ask, as soon as I'm done with that, read all my manga. That's awesome. Like, just every Monday morning, just do that, and it's just a really nice thing to be able to have.
Now, is Shonen Jump the only publisher that's gone? Because again, my knowledge of the manga world is severely lacking. Not out of any sort of fanboy rage or you know, oh well, my version of the medium is better than yours, but just, you know, ignorance. Now, has Tokyopop jumped on this?
Tokyopop's done. They're over.
Oh, like, they are.
I think they've dropped every single one of their Japanese titles.
See,
they just couldn't afford it anymore. So they've gone under.
That's right. That's okay. Now I remember, because they translated everything, didn't they? They didn't.
Okay. The other big publisher, the one who's doing Shonen Jump right now in the digital and everything, is Viz. They were the Tokyopop and Viz were probably the two big guys.
Okay.
And it sucks because Tokyopop had a lot of good licenses. They had Great Teacher Onizuka, which was an amazing series. Oh, I thought you said something.
Oh, no.
Well, yeah, so they had GTO, and they had a bunch of other good ones, and I don't know what's going to happen to those. But Viz is the one that publishes all the Shonen Jump stuff for the most part, because they have a deal directly with the publisher of Shonen Jump in Japan, Shueisha. And they also have a deal with one of the other big magazines, Shonen Sunday, which is Kodansha, I think is the name of the company that publishes that. And so if they ever wanted to, they could also publish a weekly Shonen Sunday and have that come out digitally too, and just have all these Shonen Sunday books they publish come out in like weekly chapters. Like, they have so many options if this works, and I think so far a lot of people are liking it, even though they have to catch up to it by illegal means.
Well, see, I mean, it's funny because you mentioned the one publisher going under. What happens to the all their old properties?
I don't know. I'd have to look more into it. I think the way I found out about it was I wanted to buy some Tokyopop digitally. I think I don't know if I wanted to buy GTO or something. So I was like, is there a Tokyopop app? And then apparently I found out that they barely exist anymore. It's very weird. And I couldn't find anything out about licenses.
Well, you mentioned on two shows ago, you briefly mentioned Cyborg 009 by Ishinori. Ishinomori. Okay, close. Kamen Rider.
Yeah. He's one of the gods of Japanese culture, but whatever.
No big deal. No big deal. You're just messing up his name. Yeah.
He made Kamen Rider.
But I kind of wanted to get into it because he did Cyborg 009, and the manga's out of print. And I mean, you can find it cheap, but I mean, if I can get it digital, that'd be awesome. So I'm not sure, things like that would, how are people like me supposed to get a hold of those copies without scouring the world for beaten and battered copies or going to illegal means?
Yeah, you basically either find a Japanese bookstore that sells the Japanese version and you just try and figure out what the hell's going on through the art, which in Ishinomori book, it's not that hard. He's very... very good with the art.
Well, he was a student of Tezuka.
Well, sort of. They were really contemporaries.
Oh, really? I thought Ishinomori was a student of his.
Tezuka might be older, but they really were like around the same time.
Got it.
Yeah, like he did Cyborg 009. He did Kamen Rider. He did a whole bunch of other stuff. He got into television.
Yeah, he was responsible for the Super Sentai genre.
Yep, with, Kakaider. Kakaider was his first one, I think. It was about basically a Pinocchio story, like, stolen directly from Astro Boy, really, about a kid, kid robot who wanted to be a real boy. But he was also, like, a Super Sentai fighter. So it was
and
good.
Years later, people like us have parents with all sorts of Power Ranger shit in their attics.
Yeah. Which, hey man, I still watch some of that stuff. I like Goanger, which is that's the Japanese Power Ranger stuff. And Kamen Rider is really fun. It's the bug who rides the motorcycle.
I really want to go back and like watch all of that old Japanese live action stuff.
You don't even need to watch the old stuff. The new stuff's great. It's a little hard to get into, and most of the series last an entire year. So if you want to go and watch one, it's 52 episodes.
Oh wow. Yeah. Damn.
Like, almost every season of these shows lasts a whole year.
Actually, on the note of live-action Japanese stuff, have you ever seen a movie called Big Man Japan?
No. I've seen, like, this stuff pop up on Netflix, though.
Oh, my God. You would totally love it. Do you know the premise?
I don't think I can remember it, no. I think I saw it on the recommendations, and it has, like, some weird sumo something or other on the cover.
Yeah, it's a mockumentary format until, like, the last 5 minutes. I don't want to spoil that for you, because it is one of the most amazing turns in a movie ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a mockumentary about this guy who is part of this legacy. And again, I've got a boner for legacy stories.
Mm-hmm. That's gross.
Yeah, I know. on several levels. But, you know, the heart wants what the heart wants. So his grandfather was this, you know, was this famous monster fighter back in the, you know, the 50s and 60s, and had this power to grow to an amazing size to fight these Godzilla-type monsters. And so the grandson has these same powers, but he's just kind of a joke now, because these monsters still attack, but he's just kind of the laughingstock of that legacy. And so it's him dealing with all of that and still dealing, you know, he's got an ex-wife, he's got a kid he splits custody with, just dealing with, like, the really human side of it, too.
Right.
So if you've got a free minute, like, this weekend, jump on it. You will not regret it.
Well, you know, I've still got a lot to watch. I got the Phineas and Ferb TV movie. There's a lot on my
But put this up high in the queue. I would put money down that you would not regret shoving other things out of the way for this.
I'll make some time. And on that note, I think we might be out of things to talk about tonight.
I also think on that note that you have a very solid ending to the show in that, you know, kind of a recurring ending. And now we've run out of things to talk about.
Yep, and that's exactly how you end it, because, you know, you could just keep rambling on and maybe turn what I'm saying right now, this sentence, into another hour of the show, which people like would Man. Really like because
you Animal know, Man.
What, just talking about Animal Man?
No. Wanna Beast?
Done. We're done. Sick Nasty over and out. Wanna the end. We're done. Let's see if I can figure out how to end it.
Bye.
So that was good.
Alright, awesome sauce. We done?
Yeah, man. We done.